This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hello, I'm Max Potter, and I'm joined by Dr. Ithascon Jimenez-Sira, who's from UCL, and she's talking about astrochemistry. I've just been to a really interesting talk that went from very dense astrophysical topics to some sort of very exciting, almost sci-fi stuff, so we'll get onto that a bit later. Yeah, so say hello, Ithascon, and tell us a little bit about yourself and what got you interested in astrochemistry.
Hello. Hello to everyone. So it's really a pleasure to be here. So why did I become interested in astrochemistry? Well, so this was when I finished my undergrad studies, and then I started looking around for a PhD projects, and then I got in contact with who was going to be my PhD supervisor back in Madrid, in Spain, and then he told me all these exciting things about star forming regions and how molecules can actually tell you a lot of information about them. And then I was also attracted by radio telescopes. So if you have seen, for example, the film Contact, right? So that's one of the main radio interferometers that we have. And I was always, very interested in trying to use that kind of instrument or that kind of instrumentation facilities. So I thought it was like a great thing to do.
And oh, brilliant.
Yeah, that's when I started.
I think Contact was one of the films that inspired me to be interested in physics as well, actually. That's a real blast from the past.
Yeah.
So astrochemistry, I mean, when you think of chemistry, you sort of think of Bunsen burners and flasks in the lab. But astronomy is very different to that. So how do you bring the two together?
So basically, I mean, when you look at, that our galaxy, so, and then all the space in between stars, so it's basically filled with gas and with particles, very small particles of dust. So actually dust and that gas, so those are key for these chemical reactions to occur. So when we talk about chemistry in the interstellar medium, so we are basically talking about gas phase chemistry. Okay. So we basically have like a volume of gas in which these molecules, like very simple molecules generally, like for example, carbon monoxide. So one atom, one carbon atom joined to one oxygen atom. And then we also have molecular hydrogen as well. So those are the most abundant molecules in the interstellar medium. So basically what we do is we try to understand all those gas phase reactions. And depending on the physical conditions, on the density or on the temperature that there is in particular regions of the interstellar medium, then there are some reactions that are more favorable, or there are others that lead to the destruction of some molecules. So basically by trying to understand what molecules we find, so we can track back what physical processes, or whether there was high temperatures, or whether there was a radiation field, UV photon radiation field, or whether there were shock waves. So that's the kind of things that we try to understand.
Okay.
We try to play with.
That's interesting. So you mentioned shock waves then. That's something that came up a few times in the talk. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about what a shockwave is and why it's relevant to this sort of chemistry?
Yes. You can find shockwaves in many different types of environments. So you can find shockwaves in star-forming regions. So when you form a solar-type star, basically one of the processes when the star starts accreting gas, forming a circumstellar disk, then it needs to preserve angular momentum. And then the way to preserve angular momentum is by injecting material through the poles, or, in the direction of the poles. And those, when it injects that material, then as it propagates away from the protostar, then that produces shock waves. Okay. So that's one of the regions where we can find shock waves. Another region is supernovae explosions. But in our case, so we do study chemistry in these star-forming regions because that's where most of the molecular gas is present.
Right.
So, for example, what I talked about in the talk was about one particular molecule, silicon monoxide. And silicon is one of the main constituents of these small particles, dust grains. So if you see this molecule in the gas phase, that means that you have destroyed dust grains. And then you can say that because the dust grain has been destroyed, the only way to destroy it is by shockwaves.
Okay.
So that's the way to track back.
So you sort of, by looking at the composition of these gases and these clouds, you can treat them as a kind of fingerprint or evidence
probes.
of what has happened before and the environment that they're in.
Exactly.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And how exactly can you tell which chemicals you're looking at?
Well, because of you use spectroscopy.
Okay.
so these also applies to atoms, but in molecules, every molecule has its, as you said, its fingerprint, so its spectral properties. So every molecule, so especially these molecules that are in very cold environments, so the only way to release energy is by rotational transitions. So there's a photon that gets emitted, and that photon has a very low energy. And that's when you observe it at millimeter wavelengths. So what you find is basically a molecular line. So it's a spectrum. So you have the spectrum of that molecule for what that particular frequency. But every molecule has a full spectrum across the millimeter part of the spectrum of the light. And then by looking at those particular frequencies, those particular lines, then you can know what molecule you're looking at.
Right. Okay.
Did I explain it?
Yeah. No, that's great. So can I just check I understand? It's like if you've got a full spectrum of light, like the rainbow, mm-hmm. there might be bits of it that are brighter than others, and that's those specific bits represent a kind of, they look like a barcode, right? And that's kind of the fingerprint of the molecule in some way.
So the every molecule. So if you have a look at the, because this is not in the optical part of the spectrum,
right.
You know, so it's more in the millimeter part. So then what you find is that if you have a look at the spectrum at that particular part of the spectrum, it would be like spikes.
Yeah.
Spikes across the spectrum.
Okay.
Because that corresponds to the photons being emitted by the molecule from every level, or from every level of energy, let's say.
Okay, right.
So, but it would be like spikes, yeah, like...
Yeah, that's great. Cool.
Do not change in frequency, that's why...
Right, that's the crucial thing,
yeah,
right? They're always the same.
Exactly, they're always the same because it's something particular of that molecule.
For a specific molecule, yeah.
Yes.
And then you know that if you've got a similar pattern, but it's slightly different, then it's been redshifted or blue-shifted, depending
on how
that you can build up a picture of how things are moving inside these clouds by looking at that with spectroscopy.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, brilliant. So that's how you do it. So what are you looking at with it? What sort of problems can you solve by using astrochemistry?
Okay, so by using astrochemistry, I mean, you can cover many different types of problems. The ones that I'm interested in are the ones involving the formation of the most massive stars in our galaxy. So for that, I typically observe very dark and very dense molecular clouds in our galaxy. And then you can look at them, for example, when you have a look at the Milky Way in a dark night, and then sometimes you can see that there are dark patches across the galactic plane. So those are very massive molecular clouds. And then you see those dark patches because dust is absorbing a lot of the light. So in order to detect those clouds, that's why we detect molecules, because they are in a different range of the spectrum. And we can also detect the emission of dust, but at other parts of the spectrum as well. So what I'm interested in is looking at these very dark clouds, and I observe all these different molecules to try to understand how they move, how these gases move inside them, and try to say something about how massive stars form, whether they form directly from by gravity, by having a massive core collapsing by gravity, basically falling onto itself, or whether instead you have very little seeds initially form stars, lower mass stars, and then they start accreting, or they start gathering mass from the surrounding core, and lead to more massive stars in the end.
Okay, brilliant. So that's really interesting. So you mentioned there briefly that there were sort of competing theories about how these massive stars form, and they form in these regions, these sort of molecular clouds. which we can get very nice pictures of, actually, before I talk about that. There was the Nessie Nebula that you showed in the presentation. I thought that was a really nice really nice picture. You should definitely look that one up if you're listening. Is there a reason why it's called the Nessie Nebula?
I think it's because it's, you know, it's like very wavy.
Right, okay. Fair enough. So that's even more sci-fi than just the folks talking about that.
Yeah, I didn't put the name. I think some people like to put them, you know, to give them names. I prefer to go to the technical.
Right, okay. So, yeah.
There's another one called the Dragoon, the Dragon, or the Dragon Nebula.
The Dragon Nebula, okay. Yeah, I've seen the Horsehead Nebula is the famous one, isn't it? Dragon Nebula is a much cooler name. So, in star-forming regions in these molecular gas clouds, there are competing theories about how these massive stars could be made at the same time as making the sort of normal-sized stars. How does that happen, and what competing theories are there, and how can astrochemistry be used to discern between the two?
Okay, so the current theories for the formation of these of the most massive stars, so there are two of them. The first one is the one in which gravity really takes the main role. So basically we have a very massive core, and then that collapses, or that basically gravity makes it fall onto itself, and then we form this very massive protostar inside. Then there's another theory in which, so we first form these small seeds all across the core, and then the ones that are located right at the center, so because they are at the center of what we call the potential well, so it's basically they are at the center, so gravity is exactly saying the same mechanism, so it's gravity, and then that makes those little seeds start accreting gas or gathering gas from the surrounding environment so they can grow later on. So what we've been trying to do is we've been observing these big cores, these massive cores, by using interferometers such as the submillimeter array and the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. So what we've been trying to understand is how these cores fragment, because one key point is to determine whether we see those little seeds or whether we don't see anything. Okay, and then for that, we use the emission, especially from dust. So when we go with interferometers and then we see like blobs, basically when you get an image from an interferometer, they are like blobs. And they may be like bright blobs, or they might be small blobs, more diffuse. But, you know, those blobs are important because they actually have a lot of information, provide a lot of information. So whether they are, you know, very faint or diffuse, or they have like an extended structure, or whether they are compact. So what we are finding is something in between the two theories. So we are not finding these very massive cores inside, but we are not finding either this population of small seeds. So what we are proposing is these massive cores, so they start showing some small seeds in the center. Those are seeds start accreting gas, they become more massive, and then the other seeds that will lead to the formation of low-mass protostars will appear later on.
Okay, and how does astrochemistry justify the difference between the two?
The difference between, because with molecules, so we can give information about the time evolution. So at the beginning, so we basically observe the molecular content in all these different types of cores at different stages of evolution. So the ones that show very little structure at the beginning, so we don't see any molecules. Okay. So which means that there's no protostar having any activity or in affecting very little chemically, from the chemical point of view, the environment. Then when the protostar, the seed starts accreting gas, then the protostar forms. And then once the protostar forms, that heats up the surrounding environment. And then you start seeing molecules.
Right. Okay.
So then the molecules are key for establishing a what evolutionary stage in the core.
That's interesting. So in physics, you often, when you've got a filamentation process, what happens is a sort of cascade of filamentation versus a merging of filaments. Uh-huh. And what I mean by that is let's say you've got a large scale blob of gas and it is, you know, diffuse and it's splitting up into smaller, denser blobs of gas. Those themselves can split up into smaller, denser balls of gas, which can go on to form stars. or they could merge together and form bigger stars. Is it a competition between the two scales? Because that would be similar to other physics that I'm familiar with personally. Mm-hmm. Or is it something different? Am I on the wrong tracks?
No, indeed. So for some of the cores that we are observing, so if we observe them with interferometers at even higher angular, so with higher angular resolution, which means that we observe it with finer. You know, the images are even finer and finer, basically. Do you
right.
say that?
The finer? Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So in some cases, we see that when, an initially relatively massive core was observed with one particular resolution, then it splits up in different condensations.
Yeah.
So that really happens. So that's actually the general trend. However, there are other cases in which you do observe that those cores do not split.
Right.
So you definitely form, massive, those massive cores.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, that's really cool. I think it's probably time to move on to the really exciting stuff, which is this prebiotic chemistry. Now, when I was researching before this, I had a look at what prebiotic chemistry actually meant, the specific definition of it. And I was worried because it looks like it can be a bit, it just means before life,
uh-huh.
right? But we are actually talking about the origin of life, that which is really exciting. So could you talk a little bit about your recent studies into that and why you got interested in it and what it could all mean?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I've been always interested, because basically as astrochemist, the ultimate goal of astrochemistry is to try to understand how you move from a very simple chemistry in the interstellar medium to actually the origin of life. So an astrochemist, so that's basically what everyone would love to do. We are currently doing at UCL, so is to try to see how from those very small molecules we could form in the interstellar medium prebiotic species such as amino acids. So, right. And in particular, we are working on one particular amino acid, which is glycine, because this is the simplest one that we know of. Also, this is not science fiction, because glycine has been detected in meteorites. So, when the composition of meteorites has been analyzed in the lab, so people have found over 70 amino acids. And one of the most abundant ones is glycine and the second one, alanine, or the other way around. So I'm not sure. I think it's alanine the most abundant and then the second one is
right,
glycine.
Okay.
Also, there's some work or some results provided by the Stardust mission in the Wild 2 comet. And then they also proposed that they had detected glycine. So you see, it has been like a very interesting target for astrochemists, like for a long while, for 10 years. The problem is that it is very difficult to detect in star-forming regions. So when it has been searched for, especially towards the molecular clouds around the galactic center, because the galactic center is a very turbulent region. It's very rich from the chemical point of view. There are lots of molecules. There's actually a lot of ethanol, which, as you know, so is one of the main constituents of alcoholic drinks.
Right.
So the galactic center is full of ethanol.
Okay, great. Sounds like a great place to party.
Actually, so one of my friends calculated that the amount of ethanol in the galactic center could actually give enough beer for 3 Oktoberfests. You see? So it's a lot of
brilliant.
It's a lot of alcohol.
That's impressive.
It's impressive.
So what you're really saying is that Oktoberfest people consume an astronomical amount of alcohol.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, that's definitely it. I've seen it. Yes.
Brilliant.
So anyway, so whatever, my point was that, so, when people in the past have tried to look at this region is very complicated, very, when you look, do you remember that before we were saying that in this spectrum, in the spectra towards these regions where we saw spikes?
Yes.
Imagine like millions of spikes all joined together. So if you try to find, the right spike for your molecule, then it's going to be very challenging.
Right, because it's so close to the ones that are nearby in the spectrum.
Exactly.
Right.
So then what we are trying now to do is to see whether we can detect glycine, but in simpler objects. And in particular, we are targeting what we call the precursors of solar systems. So regions that we know that they are going to be forming solar-type systems, or the systems like our our own. So for that, we've been doing some theoretical modeling, and then in the future, hopefully we will be doing some observations. So we are trying to see first, what parts of the spectrum of light we should be targeting. Okay. Because glycine is more likely to be detected in one regions and not in the others. And then second, we are trying to see what other molecules may lead to the formation of glycine. So what are the precursors of this amino acid?
Right. Okay, that's really great. So you mentioned in the talk one example of this sort of study, which was L1544, pre-stellar core. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me what a pre-stellar core is and why this one in particular was so exciting?
Yes. So a pre-stellar core, as I said before, so is like the initial conditions of solar systems. Yeah. And then it's basically that dense and cold condensation. And we know that condensation is gravitationally collapsing. So gravity is acting on it and is falling onto itself. So there's no protostar inside, so that's why it's cold, and that's why we call it pre-stellar,
right?
Because it's before a star has been formed. Then we decided to take this one in particular, and because it has been studied very well in the past, so we have the information about the distribution of the density, of the temperature, and you know that for chemistry that's very important, because those are actually the key parameters.
Yeah.
To understand the chemistry. And then we also decided to take this one because it's very peculiar from the point of view that we detected water vapor in this pre-stellar core.
Right.
So this was the first detection towards this kind of object, and that was reported in two, three years ago by using the Herschel satellite. I have to say that water observations are very challenging from the surface. So you need to go to space to actually measure water.
Right. Is that because we've got so much in our atmosphere that it
blocks? Yeah, yeah, it blocks all the emission coming from water.
Right.
So yes, and then we detected water vapor. And why is this important? So this is important because, so as I said before, dust grains play an important role in the chemistry of the interstellar medium. So dust grains are very small dust particles, so like the ones that we have here in the Earth, but they are smaller. And then these dust particles, so they are surrounded by ices. And then the main constituent of these ices is water. So if we see water in the gas phase, so this water vapor, that means that a small fraction of those ices have come off. So they have been injected into the gas phase. And those ices are actually a little bit dirty. So in the sense that they have impurities. So they have other types of molecules, other type of stuff. And then among that stuff, there are these complex organics.
Right.
So because we know that there's water vapor, we are also sure that there are going to be complex organic molecules, and then we hope that among those complex organics, we can find glycine.
Right. Okay, brilliant. So what is it about glycine in particular? Like, it's an amino acid, and it's the simplest amino acid.
Mm-hmm.
But why is that such? Would that be such an exciting discovery to find glycine?
I mean, glycine, you know, that is a key molecule for the synthesis of proteins.
Right.
And basically, we are targeting glycine, as you said, because it's the simplest one. And that means, do you remember that before we said that every molecule has its spectrum,
mm-hmm.
and has its spikes, no,
yeah.
in the part of the spectrum?
Yeah.
So the larger the molecule, the more populated is going to be that spectrum. So the more spikes are going to be. Or you're going to find. So if you target the simplest one, then it's going to be, you know, the one with less spikes, and it's going to be easier to detect.
Right.
So that's why.
Okay, so it's an easy detection.
It's easier to detect than.
Yeah. But it could mean that there are more complex proteins being synthesized.
Exactly. Or at least, you know, that we will be able to say that so it is possible to synthesize glycine, so the simplest amino acid, so it's likely that you can do also the same for the larger ones.
Right. Fantastic.
Because you also find it in meteorites, so somehow, you know, they must come, you know, from somewhere.
So that was what I was going to ask next, actually, is we usually hear about what could have possibly seeded life on Earth. Was it an impact with a meteorite, or could comets have brought it to our solar system? So is this field related to that? Are the findings that you've got comparable to theirs?
Yeah, exactly. So the idea is basically, so So the idea is to try to understand the chemistry at all these different stages. So we are probing the initial stages of the solar system, but indeed, so we need to compare, you know, the chemical composition of all these, how those organics are transferred from the gas to then to solid bodies, so to meteorites, comets, and then ideally how those solid bodies entered, you know, or went through our the Earth's atmosphere and then impacted onto the surface and were released.
Right.
So that's basically the theory or the scenario that we are playing with at the moment. But we need to do it bits by bits.
Right.
It's a very complicated
problem.
To try to join everything together, all the information together.
Very long time scales as well to join together. So, which is something that was raised at the end of the talk that we just had. You know, complex organics, these proteins and amino acids, they didn't exist right from the start of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So although glycine is the simplest one,
mm-hmm.
it's not the simplest thing that could exist. So how were these complex organic molecules made originally? And roughly, how long do you reckon they've been around for?
Okay, so then we know that these complex organics, so in order to exist, so we need to have these very tiny dust particles. Okay, so then as you know, then dust is formed very early in the universe. No, so now there are theories saying that you could form dust, large amounts or significant amounts of dust in supernovae explosions. So once you have dust, that means that all the chemistry starts appearing.
Okay.
Because you can start forming water, and then you can start forming, you know, once you have oxygen, carbon, in the gas phase, in atoms, in the gas phase, then those stick on the surface of, these dust particles, they start reacting, and then you form all these, complex organics. So what we currently know, thanks to the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, is that we see water vapor in galaxies at redshifts, up to 6.
Okay.
So which means that if you see water, you probably have other complex organics.
Right.
In that. The problem is to detect them because they are very difficult to detect.
So what do you think this means for, you know, little green men? What sort of alien civilizations and things, what can this tell us about the origins of life in the universe, not necessarily just us?
Well, I think it's... I think it's important from our point of view. So we are first interested in knowing whether these prebiotic molecules can be formed in our galaxy, because that would mean that, you know, if you form these amino acids, then that would be a natural way of explaining the origin of life on Earth. Then, what I do believe is that if you have that, do you remember that we were talking about the formation of water very early in the universe, and then that probably has related some chemistry. So I do believe that, you know, it's like the universe was meant to make this chemistry or to evolve into this very complex chemistry. And so, you know, the implications for this, for green men, that I don't know.
Yeah, so that's really exciting to think about. So I think the final question is, what is the most exciting thing about working in your field? What do you find, what's the coolest thing about your job?
I think probably, you know, all this work about trying to detect amino acids and trying to understand how chemistry can become so complex in the ISM, how that is transferred into solid bodies and then later on onto planets. I think that's going to be a big thing in the future, especially when we start exploring, you know, other planets farther away from us. So we can say something about the composition of their atmospheres or whether, you know, there's biological content within them. I think that's going to be very exciting. But we will probably have to wait a little bit for that.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
Oh, that's brilliant. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure having you on the Jodcast.
No, thank you very much for having me.